Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg. Today on Cool Science Radio, I'm excited to welcome Dr. John Medina, developmental molecular biologist, best-selling author, and one of the world's leading experts on how the brain works. You may know him from Brain Rules, where he translates cutting-edge neuroscience into practical insights about learning, memory, focus, and everyday life. Dr. Medina has spent decades researching how our brains develop and perform, and he has a rare gift for making complex science both clear and entertaining. I'm thrilled to have him join us today to explore what neuroscience can teach us about thinking better, working smarter, and living well. Dr. Medina, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
You have spent decades studying how the brain develops and learns. I'm curious, what originally drew you into neuroscience, and what still surprises you most about the brain today?
Well, the original draw, I was actually an animator and a graphics artist before I was a scientist. And but those were all about processing information. And I tell you, Scott, the impact a single professor can have on you. I was in a biochemistry class because I love the arts, but I've always been good at math and science. So I was busy trying to figure out what I should do. And this one inspirational fellow, his name was Stan Falco. He went on to become head of medical genetics at Stanford. He had just worked with a guy named Garfinkel who cloned a gene from fireflies and stuck it into a tobacco plant. And the tobacco plant started to glow in the dark like a firefly. And he brought in a picture of it. It was the cover of Science magazine. And he said, you know why we can do that? It's because the beetle, a firefly, has got DNA in it composed of nucleotides called A's, G's, T's, and C's. But it's not any different than the A's, G's, T's, and C's in a plant. You can mix and match those creatures like paints on a paint palette. And my mouth dropped, Scott. I went, oh, my God, I could do both. So I ran up to his office, ran up to his desk when he was finished lecturing, and I said, can I shine your shoes? Can I, you know, and he had a grant and he certainly needed a bottle washer. And so I entered into the world of molecular biology and never looked back. Eventually that grafted into the neurosciences. The animation component of that is strong, still strong in me. I'm very interested in how the brain processes information at a visual level. I was able to combine them. So that's how I got into the field in the first place. And that was a really good choice for me, Scott, and I never looked back.
Well, let's actually look back a little bit, Dr. Medina. You talk a little bit about how our brain wasn't designed for classrooms or boardrooms. From a biological perspective, what environments was it designed for, and how does that mismatch affect how we work and learn today?
Well, you know, I have to admit, I'm pretty skeptical. If you ask, the second part of your question was, what have we learned? And the answer is less and less.
Well, that's not encouraging at all.
It's so much more complicated than we thought. There's a lot of great progress. I don't mean to demean anything, but in terms of real results, we still don't know how you know how to pick up a glass of water and drink it, Scott. We don't know how you know how to pick up a pen and write your name with it. We don't even know how you know what your name is. So just the basics at a non-phenomenological level, we just don't know very much. Having said that, to answer your question about what it's good at, we do know something about its performance envelope. I'm in the Department of Bioengineering, so I'm going to probably give an engineering-type answer. And here it is. We know the conditions under which the brain processes information the best. Here it is. The brain appears to have been designed to solve problems related to surviving in an outdoor setting, in unstable meteorological conditions, and to do so, Scott, in near constant motion, minimum 12 kilometers a day. That's what it's good at. So if it's that good at those things, surviving in the outdoors under unstable conditions, you know, if you were to compare a modern classroom and you wanted to design a learning environment that was directly opposed to what the brain is naturally good at doing, you would design a classroom. And if you wanted to design something that was more what I'll just call cognitively congruent, I give a lecture sometimes called the five-fingered brain, and I talk about gloves. Gloves have five fingers. Why do gloves have five fingers? Because our hand has five fingers, and the brain has five fingers also. There are things inside it that it does really well and things it does very poorly. To be able to design an environment such that the five-fingered idea is now available, but in a cognitive learning capacity, You know, there's a fair amount of research you're going to have to do. Educators and brain scientists don't get together very often, and that gulp, that gap, actually remains simply because of the siloing, I think, in many ways, of the modern American system. I don't know if you know if there's a college of education that actually has as part of its curriculum brain science, but it should, because education is all about brain development. You'd think the teachers who actually are in charge of learning should know something about how the organ actually processes information, maybe know more about the organ than anybody else. And it doesn't. It's the equivalent of having a geology department, but you don't study rocks. So one of the reasons why I ended up writing Brain Rules and started to bring back a public communication part of my career, I've been mostly a consultant most of my life, primarily to the biotech and pharmaceutical industries. My research interests are the genetics of psychiatric disorders. And I spend a long time thinking about the distance between a gene and a behavior. Nonetheless, when I wrote Brain Rules, and it became a New York Times bestseller, and it's been translated in lots of languages, and it's a textbook in a lot of places, I could see that there was a hunger to try and bridge that gap. So the more we can talk about how the brain actually processes information, the little that we do know, keep your skeptical hat on and keep, hopefully I'm a nice guy, but I'm a pretty grumpy scientist. I have an allergy to uncontrolled or uncontrollable variables, particularly in the world of behavior, particularly in the world of psychiatric disorders, which is my thing and is extraordinarily complex. Nonetheless, I think teachers should know how the brain works. And I think college education curricula should be filled with essentially a cognitive neuroscience degree with a background in how you teach fourth graders.
Well, I before we started recording, I told you that I sought you out for absolutely a selfish reason here. And partly because of my background in neuroscience. I was reading a fascinating book by Monica Guzman, and somewhere in there, she mentioned your name and talked about dopamine lollipops. And one of your fascinating research areas actually involves dopamine, which is described as these dopamine lollipops. What do you mean by that? And why is dopamine such a powerful driver of motivation and attention? And why do I keep finding myself scrolling, you know, up and down my social media? What's going on with me?
Well, another way of thinking, you can call it dopamine lollipop, you could also call it dopamine spider web. We should probably go over some of the functions of dopamine and then talk about what the role is in scrolling and whatnot, perhaps. Dopamine is a Swiss army knife of a neurotransmitter. It's part of a class of chemicals called monoamines, catecholamines, and it's got some very powerful things that it does. It's involved in reward and motivation. That's what it's most famous for, but that's not all it does. It's also involved in movement, in the ability to control motor function. If you have Parkinson's disease is where areas of the brain, one called the substantia nigra, where the dopamine system is collapsing. And when it collapses, you no longer have the ability to control your limbs, a lot of your motor movements. By the way, Parkinson's is also associated with hallucinations. So there's a tremendous number of things that dopamine can do. It's also involved in learning and memory. It's involved in attentional states to focus. It's also involved in mood and emotion. So when I say the word Swiss Army knife, that's exactly what I mean. And when I say dopamine lollipop, I'm only talking about one small subset of what that chemical is capable of doing.
Well, let's talk about what that chemical is capable of doing. How do modern dopamine lollipops, particularly like notifications on social media or the constant novelty of scrolling, reshape our brains over time? Are we training ourselves to focus better, or are we training ourselves to focus worse?
Yeah, I get this question a lot. Is social media changing our brain, and what does that have to do? Maybe that's the origin of the dopamine lollipop. And I have three responses. Number one, we don't know. Regardless of what you may have heard, all of the data that are out there that are of higher quality are completely associative. They're not causal. There are very few randomized blinded trials and very few places where you can get a cohort of people that have never had social media, then give them social media and then watch for brain changes, which is the kind of thing you would have to do in order to make something go from associative to more causal. That doesn't exist yet. Number two, Scott, if you were to push me up against a wall and say, Dr. Medina, I'm not letting you go until you give me your opinion. Well, I'll give you my opinion. I do think it hurts. I do. But notice how I said that. I said, I think it hurts. Because we're not sure. It's not smelling very well. And so my second response is, I think there's a subjective reason. A lot of people smear causal with associative, and so you have to be really, really careful with that. But as long as you're careful, I've often, for people that strongly advocate for this, I often suggest that they take a course in the statistics of large numbers. So they get a better idea of what they're looking at when they see data and when they don't. But the third thing is actually hopeful with a little bit of caution, because there is some data, are some data that are going to be coming from, of all places, Australia, which is, you know, have been in the news. Australia has decided to do a moratorium on social media for their teenage populations. And at first, when I first read about that, I was a little dismayed. Not that I don't think it's an interesting idea, but it's just that, okay, if you're going to do it for the whole country, are you going to preserve some controls so that you can at least do some research that have baselines and whatnot? So I thought, oh no, they're just going to do it by fiat and be done with it. But I am now wildly hopeful, although she's got to work cut out for her. There's a pediatrician at the University of Melbourne. The reason why I know about this is that Melbourne uses Brain Rules as one of their textbooks. She's a pediatrician. She's an adolescent scientist and is in charge of a lot of adolescent behavior, across the country. Before the law was enacted, she had caught wind of it. And she went and recruited and got a whole bunch of people to study their baselines before the law was enacted, particularly the teenage populations of which Susan is vitally interested in, and got enough of a baseline that by the time the law was enacted and the hammer came down, she's already got something that she can utilize as a research paradigm. So I'm excited. I think there is that you can now have a pre-post of a sort, and you had to have done the pre first, and I think that's going to be coming. Now, having said that, she has her work cut out for her, because if you know anything about teenagers and younger, one of the first things you're going to find is that as soon as you say no, they say, oh yeah, and they'll try and find a workaround. So they're going to have to control for a lot of workarounds, and I have a feeling that the dark web and certain VPNs and a number of other workarounds, I guess you say, that teenagers are going to try and do end runs around. But as long as you control for that, she's got at least the basics, the background it's doing, and so we're going to know. So let me summarize that. We don't know. I do think there is an issue, and we're going to find out.
So there could be causation and correlation. Sure. Is that where we're heading in this?
Well, correlative data is often terrific as a flashlight. It doesn't say anything, but it can illuminate a lot of stuff. And it can allow you to look at, you know, there are certain caves, if you're groping your way through a dark cave and you've got a flashlight that is only associative, which is how I see most associative data, you can shine on certain things. And that will allow you then to go and do more responsible, more rigorous type experiments. We see that in psychiatry and the molecular basis of certain psychiatric disorders all the time, where we've known for a long, long time there are associations. But now that we know those, and some of those are so strong that it can make a believer out of you if you're not grumpy, if you're not careful. But if you are careful, one of the first things is that it will incite in you is not a conclusion, but a terrific research project to do. So then you do your randomized, your blinded trials, and you get going. And then pretty soon you've got some data that are coming. And I think that's going to happen in Australia, even given some of the confounders. So we don't know, but I think we're going to.
Okay, well, I want to stay on the dopamine trail just for 1 minute longer. If dopamine can essentially hijack our focus, can it also be harnessed intentionally? What are the healthy ways to engineer dopamine, maybe to improve learning, creativity, or performance? Or can
I don't think I'd use the word hijack your focus. It actually is involved in focusing behavior. So it's not like it's for or against, it's just involved in it. One of the things that you can say about dopamine that is insidious, that actually has something to do with social media, and you were talking about scrolling, is its role in addiction. There is an area of the brain we call, I call the highway to hell. So I'm mixing all kinds of metaphors. You've got a highway to hell associated with lollipops. It's about the size of a large paperclip, but you've got two of them. There's an area of the brain called the ventral tegmental area, and there's another area called the nucleus accumbens, and they talk to each other through dopamine. There's a dopamine part of the dopaminergic system. Every addiction that human beings get, from the behavioral addictions like gambling and pornography to the chemical addictions like alkaloids like cocaine or alcohol, all of them are deeply involved in those two areas, which is why I call it the highway to hell. So is social media. What it does is that you will get a small little bit of dopamine for a while when you're going through a social media, particularly if somebody is responding to something that you have said, and that you're going to get a dopamine lollipop out of it. But you have to be careful with that. Because like anything that's associated with dopamine and addictions, there is a law of diminishing returns. If you, the best example I can think of is crack, cocaine. You'll get a big, huge buzz the first time you take it, and that's the last time you get a big buzz. But your brain is going to remember that buzz for the rest of your life. And as a result of that, you come back to it. You say, oh, good, I had this done once. Let's do it again. But the next time you get a buzz, it's not quite as big. And the next time you get a buzz, if you go to the trough again to get whatever rewards you're getting at, it gets a little bit. And then after a while, the thing that used to incite the joy no longer incites the joy, but you need to have it just to survive. So you end up with, if we take scrolling media, for example, you're going to get a dopamine hit at first when you're first doing it. But after a while, it's not as pleasurable. It's not, but you become addicted to it. And so you need to do it more and more, and you keep searching for it. It's a little bit like a minor cocaine. You keep searching for it because you want to try and get that buzz and you don't get it. But pretty soon you're doing it all the time. And now you're doing it as a maintenance dose, not because it's pleasurable, but because without it, you just feel really crummy. And if you take it away, you can suffer some withdrawals. That has been studied. And people where the social media has been taken away get really grumpy. They get irritable. They want their social media back, and they're looking to try and get that habit restored. I can imagine what's going to happen in Australia is you're going to have a bunch of grumpy adolescents for a while because you've taken away their dopamine lollipop. So there is that. And that is concerning to me, Scott. I think there is a strong reason to do this research to find out exactly what the impact is and what are the kinds of things that you can do to solve it.
Yep. So do you think that's why we tend to remember emotionally charged moments so vividly?
Well, if I understood what an emotion was, I'd be happy to answer your question. But I have no idea what they are.
I would associate an emotional response with happy, sad, anger. Sure. Is that not a typical emotional response or an emotional feeling?
Well, I call it the Paul Ekman shortlist, which is fine. He believes not only that there are emotions, but that there are specific facial architectures that are associated with specific emotions that are universal. The problem is that when you start to drill down, and remember, I'm a molecular biologist, so I've got to be able to have something at the molecule, cellular, behavioral level, and have those things all line up. There's very few things in the behavior in my world where all of them line up, and this is actually one of them. It doesn't mean we don't mean to get better at it. It's just that right now we just don't know. So I can say to you, one of the things that do line up, molecules, cells, and behavior is addictive behavior. So there's a lot of mature research that you can go by with it. But that's about as far as I'm going to go.
Well, you're known for translating complex science into practical rules. What's one small evidence-based change people can make today to improve how their brains work?
Sure. Oh, there's a number. And one of the biggest is go out with people you love and spend as much time as you can with them.
Well, that seems like very practical advice.
It is. It's also very simple. One of the reasons why I can say that, there's a mountain of data that shows how powerful social interactions are. And there's an evolutionary reason for it, too. If you take a look at our bodies, Scott, I mean, we are really weak. You take a look at our fingernails, and they don't compare well to a raccoon's claw. If you take a look at our jaws, look at our incisors, look at our fangs, it's not particularly impressive. We have an endoskeleton that breaks all the time, and we don't have a lot of our thermal exchange with our environment is really, really iffy. We are the Pleistocene's weakest character. So you can ask the question, how is it that we became the apex predator given our biological weakness? Well, when you look out in the environment, there are a couple of ways that you could become the dominant predator. Number one, you could wait hundreds and thousands and millions of years to get your body column bigger, and so you turn from a small elephant to a big one. That's fine. That can give you domination. Or you can grow your fangs in your brain. You could do this. You can actually take a look at somebody else and say, you know, if I know about your motivations, if I form a relationship with you, maybe we can coordinate our behaviors, in which case I will double my biomass, not by actually doubling my biomass, but by actually creating an ally, a relationship. And so there was a selective pressure on us, Scott, to form relationships in a powerful, and I will say, cooperative fashion, in such fashion that we could coordinate our behaviors, double our biomass, and not have to wait several million years for the body column to catch up, but maybe a few hundred thousand years for a certain series of neurons to be able to work together in such fashion that it became social. That's something you can take to the bank. That'll pass my grunt factor, and that's one thing you can say. One of the best things you can do for your brain is go out and have a friend, and then spend time with them.
And a good time.
Yeah. Although, even if you don't have a really good time, you're at least going to exercise the relational gym, and that's fine.
Well, let's look ahead a little bit. What emerging brain search excites you the most, especially as technology is becoming more and more immersive and even pervasive?
Oh, well, there's so many exciting fronts to think of. In my own field, looking at the molecular basis of certain psychiatric disorders, it's getting better and better. We're getting clearer. It's getting more complicated. Everything I just said to you maybe 15 minutes ago still holds. But we're gaining on it, and we're beginning to understand. Here in Seattle, there's the Allen Institute has formulated and done something very powerful, and that is they've taken census of various types of cell types within the brain and are looking at particular gene expression. So we're beginning to do this. What we're missing is the cartography of the brain. We're just on the beginning stages of being able to explore it. And we as cartographers need to map the outlines of function, need to outline the parameters of structure and how structure relates to function. That's happening. And that's really, really cool.
And what about technology? What role does that play as we get more and more immersed into AI?
I'd say one of the best applications I can think of are, if you're familiar with BMIs, brain machine interfaces, do you familiar with that at all?
Okay. I am not, but this is why we call it Cool Science Radio, so we can get educated.
Okay, brain machine interfaces. You can stick electrodes inside somebody's brain, and then you can eavesdrop on how their brain is functioning and what types of neural pathways are being excited. For example, if I've got certain electrodes in your brain, and I say the word moose, your brain will light up in a specific pattern. And those electrodes, if they're attached to something that can record that pattern, will record the pattern of moose every time you say moose to Scott and can remember that. And so you can say moose and the electrical pattern happens. You can say, gumdrop. You could say lollipop. You could say almost anything. And we will record the pattern of electrical stimulation that occurs as a result of your exposure to that word. You stick that into a computer. If you think about that for a second, all you're doing is that you're training the brain on how Scott views words or how Scott's electrical patterns associate with words. And computers are learning how it is that your brain interacts once you hear a specific input. So after a while, if there's an electrical pattern that's associated that looks like moose, the computer will remember it and then will return the word M-O-O-S-E on the screen, knowing it's almost like it has read your mind, which it did, because it knows your electrical pattern.
This sounds like the stuff of science fiction.
It's much better than that, because that's been happened with people that have been shut in, where they no longer, by that I mean they only have electrical activity in their brain, but they're quadriplegic and can't do anything. You can put electrodes in these people's brains and teach the computer what happens simply by saying the word moose, not to Scott, but to the quadriplegic. And when you say those words to the quadriplegic and the brain still lights up just like it would if they were not a quadriplegic, the brain can learn the vocabulary, or the computer can learn the vocabulary of the brain's electrical patterns. And then once it detects them, can in fact spit them back out onto the screen. And that's actually happened. In fact, that's old technology now. We're beginning to understand that people who have these quads and are essentially shut-ins, just by thinking certain things like moose and lollipop and top, the computer can register it, take a look at it, and form sentences around it. And they are beginning to be able to speak into the computer, even though they've not been able to speak for decades.
Well, Dr. Medina, here in Park City, Utah, we say moose a lot. Well, with that, I want to thank you so very, very much for joining us today. This has been an enlightening conversation, and I really appreciate the time that you have spent. We have been talking with Dr. John Medina, author of Brain Rules, a New York Times bestseller, and textbooks now in many universities, which is very impressive. Dr. Medina, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Scott. A pleasure.